Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
I am very excited to go to our first call today. It is a big day for a man that will be known to all his fans as JJ Walsh, known to his friends and family as Jim. And it's a big day because he is retiring from the Irish Times as their chess columnist after, let me just say this, 70, that's 70 years of being a columnist. Jim, congratulations.
Thank you, Katie. You're very kind to talk to me and to ring me.
I am delighted to talk to you, Jim.
Well, look, you ask the questions and I'll do my best to answer them. Okay. So I'm pleased. I knew this day would come eventually, so I mean, I'd rather go out on a high, so I'm very happy in one way. Sad in another way, but, everything comes to an end.
Well, you have definitely earned a bit of a rest. How many, tell people, Jim, how many actual columns, how many puzzles have you done over the years?
I think it was about 16,000 or 16,000. I did them up until February this year. I got a bit of a turn and I had to spend 5 weeks in hospital. And after I came home from hospital, I knew my energy levels had decreased and it was a bit of a task doing the chess. So I gave this a couple of weeks to make up my mind finally, and then I let them know I'd have to bow out. So, I mean, everything comes to an end. Your colleague, Joe Duffy, he'd be years younger than me, and he'd be packing it up. And I see Rachel Blackmore has given up the jockey, and we've a new pope. So, I mean, everything changes. I'm one of a privileged group of people, but the least important.
Oh my God, Jim! But the new Pope is only a garçon compared to yourself at this stage.
Sure, everyone. I haven't met. Well, there's a few people older than me, but I went to Belvedere College, and I'm one of the last of the college, the class of 1950. We graduated in 1950.
And graduated in 1950.
A couple of years ago, one of my colleagues. We used to have an an annual lunch in a hotel, you know, to keep going. Of course, all during the years, they were decreasing. The numbers couldn't go or were dying. And in the last, one of the last years I was there, one of my colleagues said, you know, Jim, you must be the last of our class that are still in gainful employment. So,
what you are also, I mean, can I say what age you are, Jim?
93.
Wow.
March.
You're also the longest running chess columnist in history.
Yeah,
and you were that in 2016.
That's true, yeah. There's an American. He did it for 61 odd years. And there was an English player, a very strong English player, Leonard Barden. He does it for the Guardian, I think. I'm not sure what paper he does it for. But somebody asked him, who's he the longest contributor on chess, and he said, no, there's an Irishman, Jim Walsh, he does the Irish Times, and he said he's started 6 months before I did, and he's 3 years younger than me, so he's got the record.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
records are meant to be broken. Will probably come now, some young upstart will come and do it for 80 years or something like that.
I doubt. I'd say that record is safe enough, Jim.
Your records are made to be broken. But I mean, I was happy and I enjoyed doing it for the 70 years, and whoever takes over for me, they have my best wishes.
Tell me, how did you get into chess in the first place?
Well, I used to play rugby in Belvedere. I was very keen on the rugby. And in April 1945, I used to play the rugby. And one day I was in school and I had a terrible pain in my right leg, in the hip. And I more or less collapsed in school, and they rang my father and he brought me home, and the doctor came and looked after me at home, and I had a temperature and he wasn't happy with it. And he suggested that I go into the Mater Hospital for observation, and I spent a month in the hospital in the Mater, and they decided I had a TB hip. And I was placed on a frame my leg in traction and I was sent home. My mother was at home. She didn't work and she nursed me. We had a fine house and a lovely garden. And at that time, the only cure was fresh air, good food and rest and stay in bed. So I had no option but to stay in bed. And I was well looked after. And then,
like we think of TB as a lung disease for a lot of people, but you had it
I suppose you can get it. I don't know, but I presume you can get it anywhere. Anyway, I got over it. I was 2.5 years in bed. I went in every 3 or 4 months to have an x-ray to see how the complaint was progressing. And after 2.5 years in August 1947, I got all clear. And then I was about a year getting up on my feet, going around on crutches and that.
And what, you were what, 12 when that started?
No, I was 13. Actually, I was 13. The article when it was like, I was born in 1932.
So you were 13.
March 32.
When you got
13.
Sick. And that's when you started playing chess occupy
my
yourself.
My school pals used to come to visit me regularly and, you know, give me all the local news of how the school was going and all this. And they taught me how to play chess. Some of them played chess and they showed me the chess. And I immediately took to it. I said, God, this is a great game. I like this. And my mother was very good and she went around all the bookshops in town buying up all the chess books she could find herself. They were very scarce because it was after the war and newsprint was scarce. And anyway, she went in and then I got magazines from England and America and all these places and I kept them and devoured them, went over them and over them and over them. And I felt I had a good skill at the game to a certain degree. You'll always find somebody who's better than you and somebody who's weaker than you. But anyway, I loved it and it meant everything to me because I joined a chess club when I got on my feet. And my late wife, Maureen, we were married for 40 years and till she passed on. And then she was a member of the chess club. So if it wasn't for the chess, I wouldn't have met Maureen and had 40 glorious years with her. So, I mean, everything has a purpose. So I met great friends that I would never have met otherwise. And I travelled widely, went to Russia and all that.
Oh, you tell me about that, because that was back in the days of the Iron Curtain.
That was in 1956. That was the year I was over on the Irish team. We played in the Olympics in Moscow. And it was a very big event. You had to get there, we had to fly to London to Copenhagen, change in Copenhagen to Helsinki, stay overnight in Helsinki, and then move down to Moscow in a train. It took 27 hours. And then on the way back, we had to fly from Helsinki to Hamburg to Amsterdam and Amsterdam to Dublin. And then in 19...
Hang on a second. Sorry? Before you come back, what was Moscow like in the 1950s?
Oh, it was very primitive, very, very... Oh, we were well looked after in a nice hotel. It was very, very primitive and basic. But we had interpreters came with the team all the time, so we'd no problems. And we were given... we were ushered into everywhere we wanted to go, to theatres and all that. We were given all the great treatment. All the chess players were looked on very well. But then my highlight of my career, before I forget it, would be in 1958. I was on the Irish team in the Olympics in Munich. And I happened to be on the top board for the Irish team. And we were drawn in one of our rounds against Russia. And my opponent that day was the reigning world champion, Botvinnik. He's since dead, but he was one of the strongest players of all time. So I had to play Botvinnik. I remember I was very nervous playing him. I put on my best suit and shirt and to look presentable playing him. And he was very kind and he treated me very respectfully. And the game lasted nearly 5 hours. He beat me at the end, but it was the highlight of my career. It was only after that it was all downhill. So that was it. That was October
Sorry, Jim, would you get very nervous ahead of a game like that now? Get ahead of
Well, I knew playing him, it was only a matter of how long I could last. I knew he'd mow me down and beat me. But I mean, I would be a bit on tender hooks. But when I got into the game, I forgot all about who I was playing. I just concentrated, sat there. The both of us sat at the table for almost 5 hours. The game lasted nearly 5 hours. So after the game, he complimented me and we went over, analyzed where I went wrong and all this sort of thing. He treated me like as if I was an equal, whereas instead of saying, who am I playing this novice and just get rid of him. But he was very, very kind and treated me very well and I appreciated it very much. So that was the highlight of my career. But otherwise, writing for the Times was also a highlight of my career. I enjoyed that immensely.
How did that start, Jim?
Well, it started in 1955. They got a note. Somebody wanted a chess feature to combat equalise the bridge contribution. So Jack White was the features editor there and he knew me and he said, would you ever do a weekly column in the chess news and a game maybe? So I did that and I that from 1955 to 72. And then in 72 there was a big world championship up in Reykjavik in Iceland between Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky. And I used to go in at night time to help the Irish Times sort out the moves and all that. It was double dutch to them. But anyway, I helped them out.
Yeah, that was the big Cold War chess. That was like the war of its time. Yeah,
All the people were buying chess sets and learning how to play and the clubs were booming with new members and all that. So I took the ball on the hop and I said to the Irish Times, what about doing, instead of the weekly column, do a daily one like the English newspapers have, a daily puzzle. And they said, we'll give it a try. And so I started it in 1972 and this never missed it. I used to 6 weeks at a time and send it in. And then when I got a bit more older and not able to do so well, I cut it down to I'd send in 3 weeks at a time. That's 18. I'd have to research them and write them out roughly and correct them, and then I'd put them onto my computer and make the diagrams on the computer. The computer was a great help. Otherwise, I used to type out the chess on a typewriter and make the diagrams by hand. It was all very primitive in the early days. But then when I got into the computer age, it was much easier for me to do.
Will you hang on, Jim? Because I know that you have a lot of fans out there, and I have one of them on the line. Stay where you are, Desmond. You're a fan of what he writes under JJ Walsh's puzzles.
Hello, JJ. Desmond Beattie here, chairperson of the Irish Chess Union. It's just wonderful.
I'm lovely to talk to you. And thanks for ringing. You're very kind to remember me.
Well, I put up the front page or the little clip in the top right corner of the Irish Times this morning up on the ICU website. And copied the article. I didn't know you'd be on, and I was actually on my way out the door at the end of the news when I heard you coming on landline.
It's my 1 hour of glory. Everyone gets my day in the sun.
There you go. And I'm ringing to thank you for everything you've done, and hopefully
you're very kind,
Irish chess.
And I hope whoever takes over from me will give you equal enjoyment. That's all I can do. I did my best. Everything comes to an end, and I've had a good innings for 70 years. So what more can you expect?
Well, I mean, it's fantastic. How much of a runway have you left them before we know?
I don't think they get a replacement. They do reprises of the old ones that I had in until they get something to replace me. I don't know. That'll be there in their court. It won't have anything to do with me. I have no say or anything. I've completed my my stint, as it were.
And
get my pension now.
Jim, Desmond, just can I ask you, like Jim was talking about that time when chess, there was a kind of an explosion of interest in chess back at the time of the Cold War and those big set piece matches. What's the state of the chess world right now?
Well, it's interesting now because there was that whole Reykjavik bulge, as it were, and there's a whole group of players still playing. In fact, I was at the league finals, which JJ will know well about, the Leinster League finals a couple of weeks ago. And there is an awful lot of them still playing. And then things reached a sort of a steady state. And we had a membership running of about 1,000 in the Irish Chess Union for a number of years until the pandemic, when it dropped off a bit. But because the gamers discovered chess and partially the publicity from the Queen's Gambit, and because there was, you know, people were looking for new things to do online, when the pandemic lifted, every tournament that was run in this country had nearly double numbers.
Really?
The Irish Junior Championships, the Irish Championships. And with an initiative that's happening by primary schools and primary school teachers, there were as many as 14,000 primary school kids playing friendly matches against each other last term. So chess, as I would describe it, Jim, has developed over the last 3 or 4 years. I have to hesitate or say this carefully. Its own kind of cool.
I did think, though, Desmond, because the Queen's Gambit definitely made chess cool. I mean, that was a fantastic Netflix series, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing. And the one thing that a lot of chess players will tell you is it was really well researched. They didn't overdo the actual playing of the games in terms of every little detail, but each game was a real game that had been played by a grandmaster or top players. And even the final game, the one where she beats Burgoff, was a game that was actually played a few years. JJ, you might know which one it was. I can't remember, but it was when it was played, it was played as a draw. And when they went, as JJ was talking about Botvinnik doing the analysis with him, when they did the analysis after the game, they found a winning line. And that's the line that they gave to her at the final match.
Did you watch it, Jim?
No, I haven't seen the Queen's Gambit because I'm more or less housebound now, so I can't. No, I don't. But I keep in touch with all the programmes on the television. I love quiz programmes. That's what I'm confined to doing now. I do crossword puzzles, Sudoku, code word, and I like watching good quiz programmes on the television. So that's the highlight of my life now.
So were you watching University Challenge last night then?
No, I go to bed early, I'm afraid.
Oh,
but I got the results. I get it and I play it over. A Dublin lad was the captain of the winning team. I used to watch, on a Monday night was my quiz night, I'd watch Mastermind, Only Connect, and then the University Challenge.
Yes, Oscar Depard is the Irish man, the Dublin man who...
He's a Dublin man. He's very gifted. He got great results in his leaving certificate. I was blessed, though, to fall into the chess. It was meant for me, and I met people I'd never meet otherwise. And I was hundreds of friendships that I formed, and they kept up with me all the years. And I knew my rugby days were over. I still like watching the rugby, but to me, I keep in touch with all the chess, but I wouldn't be able to live with them now. My skills would have been 8th-rate by comparison with the present-day players.
Okay, so let me bring in just one second. I've got Garodine, Dr. Garodine. Ní Laois, have I got that right, Garodine?
Oh, great.
That's it, Eel Eilish. That's fine, Katie. That's grand. Yeah, thanks, Katie.
Well, anyone on the chess circuit will know you as well. have you come across Jim before?
I have indeed. I have indeed. Well, apart from reading, obviously, his columns for many, many years, and if you don't mind, it's so, I remember about 30 years ago being in a school at the time, and one particular man came up and says, "Oh, Garagine, here's a test puzzle. Sure, you can do it." I mean, the fact that it was between two Russian grandmasters, they expected me to do it inside of like 20 seconds. So the fear and the panic that I was under that day, JJ, was amazing. But I thought, I just rang because I'd love to say a few words about the high esteem in which you're held, JJ. And I think, you know, Desmond has been speaking about
you're very kind. I appreciate all the kindness that people have shown me. Yeah. I didn't realise I was so popular. Oh, no. I was expecting a tirade of abuse.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
No, you're very, very kind. I decided.
Will you let her, Jim, will you let her be kind and say say nice things about you?
I decided to go out when I was on top.
I didn't want to be told
you very much
back.
Jim.
So you're very, very kind to bother about me. You know, I've had my day in the sun and that's it.
Garagine, what does he mean to the chess world, the JJ's columns?
Very, very much. You know, so many people have read that over the years. But what I was going to say is that not only is he held in very high esteem in Ireland, but also abroad. And all chess players who are listening to this, they'll know the name Nigel Short. Nigel's one of the best known English grandmasters, one of the best and one of the best known. And I had the pleasure of taking Nigel out to see JJ. It's about 8 years ago. It's before COVID and everything goes a wee bit funny, you know, but it's around about 8 years ago. Myself and Hannah O'Leary Riley, we took JJ we took Nigel Short out to visit JJ, and you said a great day, JJ. You were showing Nigel your books, and in fact, you actually gave him a book, and Nigel, I think, had a book for yourself. And people who know Nigel, and if he's ever listening to this, he'd forgive me, but it's very hard to impress Nigel Short, I would imagine. He wouldn't be very easily impressed, but he was so looking forward to meeting up with you, JJ, and he enjoyed that visit so much.
Because my library, I gave him one about Amsterdam tournament 1950, he wanted that. He was going to play in Amsterdam some of those players. So I remember that well. We had that out in the front of my house. We posed for a photograph. I have it
that
still. I place you now. So you're very kind to ring up. If you're ever in touch with Nigel now, tell him I appreciated his visit to come to see me.
Okay.
And I wish him well.
Okay, Jim, I've got one.
I will do, definitely.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Garagine, thank you so much. I've got one more for Jim here. Charles Herbert. Good afternoon, Charles.
Good afternoon, Kate.
And you met Jim as well.
I had the honour of meeting him. I was a chess player and I used to visit Brahimi Library to check out some chess books. And Jim was there and he offered me to go around to his house and have a quick game, which we did. He probably doesn't remember me, but he had an amazing small library of chess books. And I don't know, I always followed him up on the Irish Times and the puzzle.
That's lovely to hear.
You probably don't remember me, but you were very kind.
Oh, the line. I thought we might lose Charles there. The line was going on us.
Yeah,
Jim, would you do that? Would you do that a lot? Like invite people just to have a chess game?
I try to keep private. But if anyone was keen, I wouldn't mind helping them out and giving them a game and that, you know? But in later years, I had a young boy I used to teach and he's now at the university and all that. But when the COVID came, I had to stop helping them, but now I'm beyond teaching anyone or doing anything, so I've decided to pull the curtain down on my career and go out as well as I can. That's all I can do. Can't do any more.
Well, you've done everyone a great service, and you're loved in the chess world.
It was lovely of you to invite me onto your programme. And I wish you well, and thanks very much for having me.
And we were talking to JJ Walsh, who was retiring after 70 years as the chess columnist with the Irish Times, at the top of the programme there. Christy, you were listening.
I was, yes.
And you have a connection with the chess world yourself.
Yeah, my grandson in Switzerland, he's the under 10, under 12 and under 14 champion.
In Switzerland?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They live near Zurich. He puts hours and hours into it every weekend, and they're travelling, and even off school, he'd get a week off school to go to another to whatever country he'd be playing. They're proud of him, like.
I'm sure they are. And how did he get into it, Christy?
His father liked it.
Is his father the Cork side of the family or the Swiss side now?
The Swiss side. Yeah. But I didn't really think like that there'd be somebody, you know, at that long following the chess in Ireland, because in Cork anyway, you wouldn't hear of anybody playing chess.
Well, apparently now we were hearing from Desmond there before the break that there's been an explosion of interest in the chess world.
There's a lot
of young people playing chess now. I know. I think there's chess clubs in schools up and down the country now as well.
Yeah,
isn't it a lovely, lovely thing though for children to get involved?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But it takes a lot of time. Like, a lot of practice.
Oh yeah. Well, if you're going to be at that level, playing at the level, what's your grandson's name, Christy?
Colin Federer.
Federer, like the tennis champion.
Yeah. There's nothing to one another, but that's the name, Switzerland. Like.
Well, they're both champions, obviously.
Yeah, that's true. I'd also be saying that sometimes. I must get on to it. But she's named the tennis player because we're robbed from hotels and going away for weeks. And it's a very costly sport. Like, you know, you're paying your own way all the time around. He has to go. Somebody has to go with him. Like, he's only 14. You can't let him alone on the plane. So the mum and dad has to go with him. So.
And tell me, is the plan that he will go professional? Because I think you can make a career out of this, yeah?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd say myself I'd be better off, wouldn't you, to only keep it as a hobby. I don't know.
Okay, well, I suppose we'll have to let the Federers decide that for themselves, Christy.
No, but there's only the men there. I was thinking, like you were saying, he was kind of giving up now, but you could follow him online, you know, and that might be interesting for him, like.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Christy. Only the men there under research said that they brought his name up.
Yes. Listen, Christy, thank you so much for that. The chess world abuzz today with that news that JJ Walsh is stepping down. I want to go to Joanna now. Joanna, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Yeah, Joanna, we were talking to Porrig yesterday about all sorts of things, actually, as it turned out, because he had a very interesting family backstory. But he had gotten in touch with us about his father's record collection. These were old 78 in shellac records, a lot of them. And that conversation brought back some memories for you?
It did. My late father, David McInerney, was involved with stage and theatre in Cork for all of his adult life, and he died aged 89. So when we went to look at his collection.
Joanna, your line is going in and out a little bit for us there. We just try and sort that out, and I will come back to you in a moment. Let me bring in John though. John, good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon, Katie.
Yeah, you were listening to Porrig yesterday as well.
A friend of mine rang me to say get to a radio fast. And by the time I got to radio, it was in a noisy area, and I just barely got snippets from it. But I heard John McCormack and shellac mentioned, so I wasn't sure whether it was a collection that he had that he was wanted to give to somebody, or just talking about the collection. So I'm afraid that's all I heard. But I collect shellac records and gramophones myself, so it caught my interest.
And tell me, how many gramophones have you got?
Approximately 36.
And how many records?
I've never actually counted them, but I guess I'd say about 4,500. That's a modest collection compared to some people around the world. I'm actually in conversation with a lady in England who her grandfather has passed away, and his collection has 80,000 in it.
But these are like big, very heavy. And every individual one of these is a heavy.
Oh, they are. Yeah. The 12 inch weighs, well, varies from around 9 ounces each one weighs, and the 10 inch about 7 ounces. So if you had a couple of hundred, it's like you're talking in stone weights. And they're very brittle. They're like a carrot. If you had it in your hand and you just flicked it forward, it'd snap. But so, the sound quality is brilliant for its age.
And do you have to have... Are they only played on the gramophones then? Is that how you...
Well, really. But if you had an old electric stereo, which had 78 RPM setting on it, you can use the electric stylus needle. But there are very, very few stereos now have 78 RPM. But
how did you get into all this, John?
Well, I was about 14 when I started to collect them. Because as a child, my parents were very musical and both of them loved John McCormack. And when I had asthma, and when I'd be suffering from an attack, they'd play some of his shellac records on the old Philips stereo we had at home. So I got to love the sound. So when I was 14, an old family friend of ours used to collect or sell antiques, and I was in their house one day, and sticking out from the corner was another shellac record and an old gramophone. So I said, God, I have to buy that. And from then on, I've been collecting them. It's a bit of a disease, like any collector will tell you. You keep telling yourself, I have enough, and then you see something else, and you buy that, and it continues on. But I've a wide range of recordings from various artists, speaking voice records, different genre of music, but mostly opera, really.
And 36 gramophones, John. Are they particularly? Are any of them particularly valuable, or like are there very sought after ones, or do you just pick them up everywhere?
I find that I bought one the day before the first lockdown. I saw it on an ad on the computer and rang him and got it and spent the first lockdown cleaning it. So when it was finished, I wound it up and put a record onto it, and it was amazing. It was 1919 it was made, and it works perfectly. Beautiful sound.
Hang on, John, because I think I've got Joanna back there on the other line. Joanna, are you with us now?
I hope so. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, that's much better.
Oh, great. Super.
Yeah, so you were telling us about your own father.
McInerney would have been heavily involved in Cork musical theatre for all of his life, really. And he died at age 89, and we had a huge archive of material, music scores and programmes, CDs and vinyls. And it was quite challenging. We didn't want to throw anything out. We couldn't keep it all. So it was very interesting trying to find homes for it.
And where did you find homes for it?
We were lucky, really. UCC Music Department wanted me to catalogue everything, and I really wasn't able to do that at the time. And I found a Facebook page called Cork Theatrical Memories, and people on that were great. One person came and took some programmes for research, and they put me in touch then with Cork City Music Library. And they were able to take a lot of the old musical scores that had had from shows that they would put on in the 50s and 60s. And we gave the record collection and the CDs to charities, Lisheen House and St. Vincent de Paul, and they were very happy to take them. Mm-hmm. And we were very happy to get them good homes.
And how did your dad get into opera?
Very interesting. I don't really know why opera clicked for him. He started learning violin at 10 when there was really no music in my grandparents' families. He joined a choir then after that and found his singing voice. And he actually sang in operas in Cork to a group called Cork National Opera in the 50s as well. And then he got singing into operas and operettas, Gilbert and Sullivan. He acted in all different kinds of concerts up until he was in his mid-50s when he got quite ill and he stopped singing. Mm-hmm. But he still kept performing, doing these operatic recitals, and he ended up spending 25 years presenting a CUH, Cork University Hospital Music Radio, a kind of light classical show. He did that for 25 years up until he got ill and died ultimately. So he was always interested in classical, light classical operettas, that sort of music.
And you would have grown up around all of that then, listening to all of that?
Oh, we did, yes. We loved it. We particularly loved any Gilbert and Sullivan. They were great fun. We did Pirates of Penzance when we were in school as well. I think Dad had directed us and we all got parts as second policemen and different things. So we always grew up with music. Now, none of us are real opera buffs, but we would all be quite musical. And it's lovely. It's a lovely heritage to have, really.
It is, isn't it? It's a lovely thing to be able to pass down to your kids, that kind of a love. Particularly operettas are such, they're such fun.
They are such fun and they're kind of lighthearted. Some of the opera would be quite serious and hard to, I suppose, hard to understand. But the operettas were all about everyday stuff and silliness and foibles and misunderstandings. And it all worked out in the end, of course.
Yes. It is the ultimate happy ending genre for sure. Joanna, thanks for that. Let me bring in Raymond now. Raymond, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Yeah, Raymond, you got in touch with us after the show yesterday because, as we say, the whole point of Porrig coming on the show was that he wanted to find a home for this collection of records.
Indeed.
So tell us.
It was a bit like. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was saying you're based there in Ballina.
We are indeed. I work out of a bookshop. We're called Pangerbone Bookshop, and we opened up about 4 years ago. And I've always been interested in collecting vinyls. I haven't started collecting until about 4 years ago. But a lady, she gave me her entire collection a couple of years ago, a lovely lady called Barbara Birak, a German lady, because her husband had a huge collection and she was looking for a new home for it. And I said, I would gladly take it off her. And since then, I've been building a very, very versatile collection, a very eclectic mix of all different types of vinyl, and I play them at home most of the time, and I just love the whole ritual of playing vinyl, you know, taking it out of the sleeve and dropping the needle, and I mean, you have to slow down to listen to it, you know, so I think it's really special and different, and I think that's why so many young people have come back to vinyl, you know, timeless.
Do you play music in the shop?
At times I do, yeah, when I have time, but often when I'm busy, I just don't have time to flip it, you know, and I can't stand having any dead noise, but I love playing them, I just don't always have the time to do it, but it's a wonderful thing to play vinyl, and it's just the sound, it's just unlike anything else, you know.
Now, would you have anything that you could play at 78 RPM? Because that's
sure.
What a lot, oh, you do?
Well, I could, yeah. I have a couple of record players, so I'm sure I could accommodate it, you know. But I just love collecting, too. I mean, I have a very, very eclectic mix. I mean, that's every genre is there, and I just love to collect. It was like your other listener was on, you know. A friend of mine told me you need to get to the radio right now and then tune in. So I was just like that other, your other caller there.
How many would you have now? Because we've got a bit of competitive collecting going on here.
Oh, well, it's not that massive. I've about 400. So that's not too bad because I only started collecting a couple of years ago. But it's building and building.
And do you have like certain ones that you are your kind of that you take out and look and put back and take out and look at and put back as in your prize?
Well, I have a lot of the Beatles and I have a lot of Bob Dylan and Neil Young and Led Zeppelin. I have a double Led Zeppelin album. And every one I pull out, you know, has its own charm to it. And, you know, with the individual badges and they've come from all over the world, too. You know, so there's a lot of variety with them. I mean, I think that's the thing with vinyl. There's so much variety.
And I'm just thinking in terms of music as well in a bookshop. I wonder, is there a science to this, the type of music that will make you browse longer, buy more?
Well, I think certain types of music work better. You know, jazz is very good, especially music without lyrics works well too. Well, for more so for when you're reading, I find the lyrics can kind of sometimes distract you. But I think jazz is very, very good. Classical as well. A bit of opera is very good too. It's just, It goes with the territory. I think when you're browsing, you need a certain type of music. And I think little opera, classical lends itself to that, jazz especially too. So they work best.
Any kind that would send the customers running from your shop?
No. I'd only play that when I'm cleaning up, you know. I save the heavy metal for later.
Do you have some death metal in there, Raymond?
No, I that's the only genre I'm not crazy about. But I do like some hard rock is good. I got some AC/DC and things like that, but nothing too crazy.
So were you interested in Porrig's collection of maybe taking some of them off
sure.
his hands? Yeah,
absolutely. I'd be happy to, you know, if he's willing to part with them. I mean, I'm always interested in growing what I have. But I would be eager to, because I do listen to lots of different genres. I mean, it's just dependent upon your mood, you know. Music is all about how you feel, so you have to match the music with the mood, just like books.
And now, hang on a second, let me see. John, were you hoping to get your hands on a few of Pádraig's records as well?
Well, I would, yes, if that would be possible, yes.
Okay, well, we might
have to go through them to see what he has.
Well, we'll have to put you all in touch with him. I don't want to be Solomon here trying to divide up a collection.
Of course.
Because I'm sure Pádraig will have his own thoughts on that. Now, I suppose I need to ask you both, have you got a good home for them? Because that was the whole point of Pádraig's call yesterday. Raymond, do you have somewhere for them? I mean, obviously, you need to be able to mine vinyl. That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. I'll mine them. I'll look after them myself. I have a place. I have a growing collection, so I do have a good spot for them, and I wouldn't be moving them on. I'd be keeping them myself.
John, what could you want to make a pitch there for how you're going to mind any potential collection that comes your way?
Well, unlike vinyl, which is flexible, you can bend it. The shellac, if you go to bend it at all, it snaps in half. It just snaps like a carrot. So every one of them I have is in this original cardboard sleeve, put inside a plastic sleeve and kept in the horizontal position, or vertical rather. I have the old timber cases that they're in. They're on good solid mahogany shelving and they're safe and sound. They're all happy together. But as I say, I've been collecting them for 40 years, so I know how delicate they can be.
I think you know what you're doing. I think you both know what you're doing. I'd be very confident in passing your details on to Pádraig, and I'm sure he'd be delighted to talk to you about it. Lovely to talk to both of you. Raymond, thank you, and John, thank you.
We'll talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Is even liam nach nianan tu charmed riaf ar la mór. Is even liam garfeid liam e yana gachni nu a liog li chéile nach tu a ta solupa.
On cadunas telefíse, beidon och dan ín sealad a ta sef os le hiog. Sine an dili, socrig de gochar dírach an ish ar tvlicense.ie o Rialtas na Héireann.
All access to Audi is all yours with the 252 Audi range. Enjoy exhilarating test drives, exciting offers, introductory incentives, and exclusive product packs for a limited time during Audi All Access in dealerships nationwide. Discover all the advantages to owning a new Audi this summer. Terms and conditions apply. Audi. Vorsprung durch Technik.
The Ray D'Arcy Show, weekdays from 3 on RT Radio 1.
Coming up on the show today, we meet Ian Shaw, son of Jaws star Robert Shaw, who's in Dublin for a run of his play, The Shark is Broken. And amputee and Paralympian Tiernan O'Donnell chats to us from our Cork studio about the loss of his leg, his plans for the LA Olympics and more. Our WhatsApp number is 0870 32 32 32. We will talk to you after Liveline.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Revamp your home this May with our fresh new curtain embedding designs. Discover comfort and style for every room.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we were also yesterday talking to Paul Mescal Sr. About AmDram, Amateur Drama. The festival, of course, is running all this week in Athlone, the All-Ireland Drama Festival. It's an extraordinary world all of its own. Edward, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you keeping?
Very well, Edward. You've been involved in this since you were a lad.
A little chappy, yeah, absolutely, Katie. And I think that's what's so special, you know. And I was listening to your earlier contributor, JJ, about the world of chess. And I think really what he showcased today on the show was the whole passion of a hobby. And I think that is very much endemic in the world of drama. I joined when I was 12 years of age, a local group down here in Greignamana in County Kilkenny, where I live. My next door neighbours, Idel and Martina, brought me down. And I always say the group didn't want me when I joined because I was only a chap and it was predominantly an adult group. But I stuck with it and just really enjoyed it. And I know people then took to me and I helped out. I remember one of the ladies in the early days was playing Nellie the Post in a play called The Righteous Are Bold, and I wrote out the Hail Mary in Irish for her that she had to say during the play, and she gave me 50 pence for so doing. And like, it is fantastic, and you know, it's multi-generational and intergenerational, and it doesn't matter who you are, your age, your gender, your profession, your status, none of it matters. It's really just teamwork at its best, and it exemplifies that, you know, everyone working together. It's like as if you're working in communion for a shared endeavour. I was telling your research earlier on, akin to hurling or football. It's like getting a play performed and over the line. It's like pucking a ball from one end of the pitch to the other. You're pucking it to your teammate, and everyone is involved backstage, front of house, up house, out house. It's amazing, Katie.
How many productions would you put on in any year? Would it be just one a year?
Well, listen, it all depends. I suppose I'm coming to you today with a number of hats on, both as a performer, but also my role is the chairperson of the Drama League of Ireland. And the Drama League of Ireland looks after, I suppose, all of the groups all around the country in terms of supporting them and supporting what it is that they're doing through education and training and help and advocacy and all that jazz. But all the different groups, I suppose, have their own autonomy. Some groups will put on a play once a year. Some groups will put on a couple of productions. They'll do summer productions. They might do writing workshops in their own community. But I suppose there's two different types. I was performing at the minute with Ballycodley Players, the wonderful Ballycodley Players. We opened the RTE All-Ireland Drama Festival last Thursday night with Lend Me a Tenor, directed by Pat Whelan. But there are groups that do that who go on the competitive circuit, both in the full length and the one act. But then, Katie, we represent an awful lot of groups who just bring drama to the community. And that's what's most special. Where I'm talking to you from today in my native Craignamana, if you were to spit, you'd land on a drama group. There's about seven or eight within a 15 or 20 mile radius from my house who bring drama to the community. They put on great plays. They work on it like you'd have no idea what, in terms of putting all the work together to bring it. And that's about the accessibility. We're living in a world of equality and diversity and accessibility. This is accessibility. You don't have to go to the large theatres. You don't have to go to the professional groups. It's there with the people you know, brought to the people we know. And community theatre is fantastic.
And that's extraordinary. Really, seven or eight drama groups in a 15-mile radius of Craignamana.
Absolutely. We are the metropolis of drama down here.
But
no, all joking aside, Katie, that is the case right throughout. I mean, if you were to go onto our DLI website, you'd see the drama groups every corner of the country. One of our ladies, our membership officer, is always talking about doing a piece of research about even the names of the drama group and the list of heritage that's around that. The group that I'm with at the minute, Ballycodley, was only talking to their chairperson, Sean Carthy, the other night prior to our performance. They're celebrating 50 years. And the two of their founding members were at the performance the other night in the theatre in the Dean Crow. And that sense of pride of putting something together is fantastic. It's a shared interest. It's like your own language, Kate. You have to join a drama group because people talk about this drama, family and community, pride and the sense of belonging. It is like nothing you've ever experienced. It's amazing. And it's there in every corner of Ireland, in the 32 counties. It's there. And there's a complete explosion of drama happening. There's joy, the joy that it brings, the joy that we get. So we give a bit, we get a bit. The long-lasting, meaningful friendships. I have some of my best friends are from the world of drama. And all drama people want to talk about is drama. When we go down to the summer school, the DLI run a summer school in UL every year, which is all tutors, international and national tutors. Nobody gives a hoot what your job is. Nobody gives a hoot how many children you have or how many wives you have. They're only interested in what play are you doing? What play are you going to do? How was it? How was it fantastic? What was the story arc? What was the narrative? What was the drive? It's really a language of its own. It's a unique vernacular, Katie.
But Edward, now, that all sounds lovely. But
you want an audition.
No, that too. I'll be back to you for that.
I knew it.
I'm going to say,
I'm told that when it comes to the competitive end of things, and groups are going at it for Athlone, that things can get fairly rough.
Well, I won't say rough, Katie, but certainly tough. No, listen, it is highly competitive. Just remember, a lot of groups go out to want to compete to get to Athlone or get to the confined finals, which this year took place very successfully in Claremorris. A lot of people want to do it. Obviously, not everyone can do it. If you were running a race, if you were on the 100-metre hurdle, the first man, woman or child over the line is the winner. This is completely open to subjectivity. It's adjudicated. So it is tough. A lot of people put themselves out there. A good friend of mine, Maura, always says, you know, when we're talking about adjudicators, we ask them to comment on it. So by adjudicating or by entering yourself into a competition, you're asking people to comment. And you could be lucky enough, but a huge amount of work goes into it. But just remember, everyone is doing the same amount of work, but it's all about how that show responds to the marking sheet, how the adjudicator responds to it. But to get there, it is highly coveted. But I mean, if you were to be in the world of Facebook, of drama now over the last couple of days, everybody, it's like a love-in. Everyone is wishing each other the very best. Whether they mean it or not, Katie, I'm not convinced. But ultimately, everybody wants to win, don't they?
You took the words out of my mouth there now. The sincerity maybe in that one might be in question. Edward,
well, we are actors, Katie, remember that.
Exactly. Edward, absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
Likewise,
for that.
Likewise, Katie.
Mila Buikas. Jack, good afternoon, Jack.
Hiya, Katie.
Right, so you're down there in Tallow in Waterford. I know it well, that part of the country.
We have a very strong drama club here in Tallow and County Waterford, and we put on local productions every autumn. We put on a local production, and then we do the festival play, which goes on in usually the competitions are in the month of March, where we'll be performing it throughout February, getting ready to hit the road.
And do you go on tour with it? Do you, or do you just go to Athlone?
No. You have to compete in the maximum number of festivals, these drama festivals, the qualifying festivals. You can do a maximum of 8, and we try to do the maximum of 8 to give ourselves a chance of qualifying for that one, which is the objective from the beginning, is to try to get a couple of wins and maybe a few seconds. Or if you get 3 wins, you'll probably be okay. But we managed to get in with two wins and 2 seconds this time, and it's our third time qualifying. We qualified for the first time for Athlone in 2018 with Stone and Child by Babin de Creve and Yvonne Quinn. And the following year, we were lucky enough to qualify again with Philadelphia, Here I Come by Brian Friel. So we've been waiting for a while now to get back, but we managed to get back. We're doing a lovely play called The Wheel by Conor McPherson.
Oh yeah, I actually saw a drama group from Claremorris at the Mount Mellick Drama Festival do The Weir in February. It's a fabulous play, and of course Brendan Gleeson has taken that to the stage now. Next year we're hearing about that.
I saw that advertised. Yeah,
it's a fabulous play. And tell me, what do you actually get from it yourself, Jack? What do you get from being involved in this?
The kick there for me, I direct the play, and I have, we're nearly like Hollywood. We have an assistant director here in Tallow, my friend John Roach. It's great to have two heads, they're always better than one. But our objective is to try to take the text, transfer that into action, emotion, all the elements that are required. And then also, like, I help the actors. It's really the actors who have to do the work. My job is to try to prompt them, or not necessarily direct them distinctly in any particular direction, but just to help them, particularly to find the character. That's enough. I can learn the lines for them. They have to learn the lines themselves. But our other function then, and this is where John is very good, my friend John Roach is very good at, is the placing of them on the stage, what we call the blocking, which of course is very, very important for it to be natural, the movement around, because the wheel is set in a pub. So, like, you have fellas sitting on high stools and fellas sitting on low stools, and the man behind the bar, and they're going to the stove and they're going in and out the door. So all that movement has to be matched and fitted in with the dialogue and with the action, with all the things that are happening.
And are you in the running? Are you in the running there still then in Athlone? Have you had your performance?
I hope we were on Friday night and it went very well. We were very, very, very pleased with the performance. And Walker York is the adjudicator. Only he knows how well if we're in the running or not. But really, for us, the big thing was to qualify to get back to Athlone, because it's a brilliant thing for the actors and for the set crew and for myself and Emily, my daughter Emily, who's on sound, and the stage managers, Helen and Rosary, that we performed in Athlone to well over 400 people. And it's a fantastic buzz just to actually qualify.
I'm sure it is, and to get there, it's like getting to the All Ireland if you're in GAA, isn't it? It's the pinnacle of all your work. Listen, Jack, thank you so much for that.